This is Dr. Todd May for the podcast series Living Philosophy, brought to you by philosophytoyou.com. Living Philosophy explores the way people have brought philosophy to life through significant experiences, changes, practices, and life-affirming realizations. My guest for this episode is the author and historian Gregory Crouch. He is author of one of my favorite books, China's Wings, which, to quote the review of fellow author James Bradley, recalls the remarkable encounter between an ancient civilization and the most modern technology in the world as intrepid Americans and their Chinese partners struggled to establish a sophisticated air network over a vast land that barely knew electricity during World War II. Greg is also an accomplished mountaineer, and he has penned a memoir about his adventures on Patagonia in the Random House book, Enduring Patagonia. Greg's most recent book is The Bonanza King, which tells the story of John McKay and how he made his fortune taking control of the Nevada Comstock Lode in the 1860s. Greg is a graduate of West Point Military Academy, and his life-affirming mantra is something along the lines of endeavoring to follow his intellectual and adventurous interests to their absolute conclusion. Welcome to Living Philosophy, Greg. It is a pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Todd. It's great to be here.
So you are a graduate of West Point Academy, as well as Army Airborne and Ranger schools. And I was wondering if the military was a channel for you to get involved in history and traditions, or was it the other way around that you had an interest in history? Something happened while you were enrolled in the academy and history sort of stood out as something that you wanted to pursue.
Well, history, I've always really loved history. The two like oldest things that I love are history and books. And I've loved them since I was a boy. When I was, both my parents are English, and although I grew up in California, we would always go back to England to visit family. And things, you know, old things in England really made an impression on me as a little boy. I loved going to castles, and both of my parents' families had been pretty intimately involved in both world wars. So, you know, the history of that and the stories about that really captivated me. And I've never seen history as anything but a collection of stories about people doing things. You know, it's really easy for me to find the story in history, and that I've just always found captivating.
And is there something about military history that was always a part of that interest as a child, or was it something else that sparked that interest?
Well, it's probably the same thing. You know, my dad was like 6 to 12 years old during the crux war years of the Second World War. So he lived in East London. He slept in bomb shelters for years as a little boy, and, you know, looked up at the sky to watch the Battle of Britain when he was young. He was one of only 2 kids in his grade school that did not evacuate. So they stuck it out in East London through the whole of the Battle of the Britain and the Blitz. One of my great uncles on that side had fought with the London Rifles through all the years of the First World War. And then on my mother's side, they lived way out in the countryside in Shropshire, and they had received evacuees from Liverpool and Birmingham. And then also one of her uncles, so my great uncle on that side, had fought with the Coldstream Guards in the First World War, and he was actually killed in 1918, unfortunately. So, you know, this military history stuff was very much a part of my growing up, and I just read the heck out of it when I was a kid.
And was it, I guess there's many different areas of military history, I suppose, and one is you find some academics and historians who are interested specifically in military tactics. My wife was interested. She did her PhD on Roman medical care on the frontiers, which was interesting to see how that differed from medical care in Italy or Rome. And then what I've noticed from your books is that, I don't know if you've had a chance to stand back and reflect, but certainly with China's Wings, there were extraordinary characters, and war battle becomes this environment or milieu where it really forces some people to confront extreme adversity and try and rise above it. And so you get the molding of these very interesting characters, their takes on it, how they overcome certain challenges or whatever it might be. And so that certainly comes out in China's Wings. And although the Bonanza King is not set during a war, it's almost a lot of the description you bring out, it is so, almost like a, I don't know the term, like a social war. There's so much violence going on at the time that really forces someone like John McKay. He seems to be an oddball in that respect, because he's not really participating in the kind of, I don't know, the the fallen ethos where people are out being violent and drinking all the time. There's something, is it, are those the kinds of things that military history brings to life for you, or is there something else to it?
Originally, I was very much like a battle history guy. I was very much interested in like the history of individual battles. So I've read a zillion battle narratives through the years and still do read those. As I gotten older, I become sort of less focused on like reading those eyewitness stories, but putting them into a larger context of, you know, the major issues that drove the wars and the, you know, what results happened to them. Like, I become very interested in both the pre and post Civil War in the United States, whereas I had read hundreds, not maybe not hundreds, but dozens of battle narratives about the individual battles. Now I'm more interested in like the social context of the war, both before and after. And, you know, the Reconstruction era in particular still has massive ramifications in the modern United States, which we're barely coming to grips with right now, and indeed don't really want to come to grips with, because so much of it is so ugly.
I had a colleague who was a professor of sociology, and he remarked this was in a non-academic setting, but he's a climber, and he remarked casually to me, or actually it was a question. He said, "Do you know what the most segregated city in the United States is, based on segregation based on race?" And of course, I was thinking somewhere down in the South. And to my astonishment, he said it was actually at the time, it was actually Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I would have guessed Milwaukee, Chicago, or Detroit, but.
Yeah, and it was a bit of a shock, because you always tend to think about segregation as a Southern thing, based upon, you know, general understanding of the Civil War. And the Reconstruction periods always interested me, not as a specialist in that era of history, but I often wonder, just on a kind of folk psychology, if the Reconstruction period worked to the detriment of the United States, it actually forced more division between the two regions, or if that is just a kind of a corny idea.
I think that we missed a tremendous opportunity to build a better society in the late 1860s and 1870s during the Grant presidency, and really missed an enormous opportunity, you know, to push that through to a true equality, you know, to sort of realize the self-evident truths. And when Reconstruction failed, and there's the tremendous backlash that leads to, you know, a century of Jim Crow and more oppression, you know, the United States had really failed to live up to its ideals. We had a real chance, you know, we had a real chance to make something better at that time, and failed.
And does anything, one of my questions I wanted to ask you was about the cliche, which I by no means take lightly, but the cliche that we ought to learn something from history, and that can be understood in many different senses. I was thinking, with the Reconstruction period, you're saying that we had an enormous opportunity. Is there anything that stands out, that a particular policy or a particular event that was the catalyst for the failure of that Reconstruction period?
Well, I think sort of Northern war exhaustion, you know, the North got tired of having the army deployed in the South to enforce the provisions of Reconstruction. You know, the original KKK was absolutely a domestic terror organization. They were murdering, you know, dozens, hundreds of Blacks and Republicans, white Republicans that were supporting them in the South. And so, you know, the army and the nation was essentially fighting a counterinsurgency campaign, and it got tired of it and quit. And, you know, there's the horrible compromise that's made over the presidency at the end of the Grant administration, where you have the election that nobody has won, and the Southern Democrats agree to back the Northern Republican if he'll withdraw the army from the South, which is tantamount to Northern surrender of the ideals of Reconstruction. And then, you know, you have the Jim Crow era come in immediately after that, the suppression of the Black vote, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the country doesn't even begin to recover from that until after the Second World War with the Civil Rights era.
And do you see any parallels of the Reconstruction, the failure of the Reconstruction, with what's going on today, or is that too tenuous?
Yeah, absolutely, because there was no reckoning forced, right? And we have this total false narrative of what the South was really fighting for. you know, the whole lost cause thing, which sort of allows you to maintain some semblance of the moral high ground as a white Confederate. And, you know, we have not got past that. No way.
And do you have any idea how we might begin some kind of restoration, whether it's through stories we tell? I mean, or, you know, the
stories are really powerful. I think that has a fair bit to do with it. I mean, the U.S. Civil War is the very rare war in which the losers wrote some of the most influential history, right? The whole myth of the lost cause is very much a Southern whitewashing of what had actually happened. And that, you know, has become standard doctrine in the United States until quite recently have historians started actually saying, like, hey, wait a minute. And I got to, you know, when I was a cadet, and you know, there's Lee Barracks there, there's plenty of Confederates that are honored at West Point. And, you know, Grant didn't have a statue there until just a couple years ago. And he's for sure the greatest general that the United States has ever produced. And it's not close, I don't think. But part of the glory of the Confederacy, you have to run down General Grant because he just beat the living hell out of the Confederates wherever he fought them, from Forts Henry and Donelson in the West in 1862 all the way to Appomattox in the spring of 1865. Grant didn't lose. And you have to denigrate him as a combat commander in order to make your Southern boys look much better. And it's only recently, it's only a couple years ago that a Grant statue was unveiled at West Point, and he's the best general officer the United States has ever produced, and he ended up as president.
I think the other thing that colors how we look at General Grant or the president is that he had a drinking problem, so therefore people think that he wasn't very good. But I understand that's actually the opposite. He was quite astute as a president as well.
Yeah, I recently read the Ron Chernov biography, and I knew a lot about Grant, the combat commander, but very little about him as president. So that was a big eye-opener. It doesn't seem that Grant's drinking affected his ability to lead an army successfully. And, you know, there's that famous Lincoln quote, was like, he drinks, well, find out what whiskey he drinks and send it to all of my generals, because this man fights. I always was very uncomfortable with Confederate history. I didn't get like the glory of Robert E. Lee and stuff. I don't think that he's as fabulous as a commander as people make out. You know, he didn't have a strategy for winning the war. He lost his two most important battles at Antietam and Gettysburg, made terrible decisions at Gettysburg, absolutely atrocious decisions. And still he's held up as this paragon of the American fighting man when he broke his oath to the Constitution. It's hard to get your head wrapped around that in my mind.
It sounds like a book on Ulysses S. Grant might be in the offing for you, or is that ground too well?
I think that's probably, unless my angle isn't so much to take a figure like Grant, who has been very covered, and do him again. My angle would be to find something that hasn't been told and really focus on that as a story. I mean, that's kind of the deal with both China's Wings and the Bonanza King. Writing about a guy like Grant, you know, I'd have a really hard time competing with the academic historians in that regard. And I would be perhaps not confident enough in my ability to do so. But what I would be really confident in my ability would be to find a story or an angle of a story that nobody had gone over before, find some good primary sources, and, you know, gin up a unique character or spotlight a unique character, a unique story that happened in Grant's milieu, which would allow me to make some commentary about Grant, but not actually write a biography on him. I'd have a hard time selling that book, Todd, because one of the things that a publisher needs to be convinced of is why this writer. And I'd have a hard time convincing somebody that, you know, I was the right guy to write about Grant.
And with, I'm interested in the creative process, if that's the right word, of being an author of history and dramatizing that. And by dramatization, I don't mean adding things in that didn't happen, but bringing color, bringing action, bringing characters to life, bringing text to life and events to life. Is it, you have an interest in a general event or a person? And like you said, you just start to do some digging and looking for something that has been missed? Or is there another process by which you come onto the kinds of events you've written about?
That's a really good question, Todd. So I don't consider myself a history writer per se. I consider myself a writer of narrative nonfiction. So a book like Seabiscuit is going to be the absolute top of the genre, which and a great work of narrative nonfiction ought to crack open a world that you previously knew nothing about. So Seabiscuit, that's my idea of like the perfect piece of narrative nonfiction. I didn't know the first thing about Depression era horse racing. But there, here that book cracks open this world that's totally fascinating through the vehicle of the horse, and all the characters that are around that are really compelling, and the horse does incredible things. You know, I just think that book's magnificent. So when I'm looking for a story, and the perfect example is The Bonanza King, okay? So I had finished China's Wings and I needed a new story. China's Wings was great fun to do. I really enjoyed, many of the people were still alive when I was writing it, so I did all these excellent interviews. But that story had one crippling problem, is that every time I wanted to visit a location, it was on the wrong side of the Pacific Ocean. So I could really only afford to go once. So when that project was done and dusted, I'm like, okay, there's got to be something good closer to home. And so I was ferreting around in the early history of San Francisco, and I kept running across all these connections to the old Comstock lode. And if you know how to look, they're kind of all over San Francisco. And so I started looking into that, and my mom had taken me to Virginia City when I was a little boy, and I had good memories of that. And so the first thing you do is read everything that you can about a topic. And I read, I don't know, must have read 10 books about the Comstock Lode and visited Virginia City again as an adult. And, you know, it seemed that all the authors had either gone down one of two avenues. Either they were very dry and academic studies of the mining industry, which wasn't going to capture a general audience, or they had completely fallen in love with the whiskey and the gun smoke and the hooker with the heart of gold story, which when I'm up there in Virginia City and looking around at the old mine dumps, they're massive. And I'm like, these guys dug this out by hand. You know, this is a working man's story, not a Wild West story. And so it seemed to me that there was a pretty wide channel right down the middle to tell the story of the Comstock Lode from what it really was, which is one of the great epic economic struggles of the 19th century. And so from that realization, like, wow, there's an unplowed field here, to I need a character to tell that story. You know, like in China's Wings, it's William Bond who kind of carries the action. I need that dude in the Comstock Lode. And that search leads very quickly to John Mackey, because, you know, he's the seminal figure in the history of the Comstock Lode, rises from common miner to the Bonanza King, one of the richest people in the world over the space of about 15 years. That's a story, you know? And so that's what really compelled me, was on one hand, like John Mackey's story, and on the other, like, how the hell did they do this? Because the whole engineering of that was just absolutely fascinating to me. They had to invent the entire modern American mining industry to go after that wealth. And it was astounding quantities of wealth. You know, it's definitely the Silicon Valley of the 19th century. If you put those sums into modern terms, you're talking tech industry dollars, you know, billions of dollars of equal economic emotional impact. And that's why those guys were willing to risk their lives in those mines, because there were billions of dollars at stake, even though in those times it was tens of thousands and millions of dollars, but today it would be billions. You buried 600 billion modern dollars 1,000 feet down in Nevada, and all those tech bros would be riding their scooters over the Sierra to dig at that.
So not a story about the Wild West, but a story about the working man at the time. You had that realization. Do you remember, so I'm really interested in the creative process, because there's something that runs parallel with doing research in philosophy in many ways.
Yeah.
But was that realization something sudden when you were looking out onto where the mines used to be, or was it a gradual, sudden, you know, things get pieced together, or was it the penny drop right away and then you saw it?
I'm not a guy that the penny drops on right away, Todd. I'm way too dumb for that. What has to happen for me is like the total immersion. It all comes out, you know, it came out of reading 6, 8, or 10 books about it, reading a bunch of old newspaper articles that were, you know, contemporary. It comes out of the sources, you know, kind of immersing yourself in the story, even just testing the waters as you're deciding if this is something that you can pursue. But then the realization kind of gradually builds in me. And at some day there probably is like what you might describe as a penny drop thing, but that doesn't happen without a vast amount of homework underneath it and a big solid foundation. I'm sure that's the same in philosophical work as well. It's the immersion in the topic that creates the potential for having the penny drop.
The other thing that happens in philosophy research, I'm curious if this is what you experience. There's a certain anxiety, certainly that I have, is when you start researching an area and you have an idea of an original argument, or in the case of narrating nonfiction, an original take on how events unfold. And then you start doing more reading, and in the back, you have this anxiety of, I need to read more, this is interesting, but I don't want to come across someone else who's even close or remotely close to what I'm trying to demonstrate.
You are speaking my language there, Todd. And I never really lose that anxiety. Even when at the end of these projects, when you've kind of emerged as like the world's expert on this obscure topic, and like I still get questions from like actual East Asia historians that'll email me about CNAC related things. And I guarantee you that the best CNAC related archive is in my garage right now. I never lose that anxiety that I've somehow missed the crucial stone, that there is one last nugget that would have absolutely cinched this argument, or indeed like not just a nugget, but like the hint of a much bigger thing behind it that I never recognized that I should have dug at, you know? So I never lose that anxiety.
An anxious life. I want to come back to the cliche that we should learn from history. Otherwise, the other part of the cliche would be we're condemned to repeat the mistakes of the past. And simplistic in many ways, because it assumes that the same kind of mistakes reoccur through history, and you know, the philosopher would probably say, well, they might be similar, but they can't be the same in any kind of fundamental sense. But certainly there's a lot of things that, I guess how I would put it is, a philosopher is interested in narrative in this area called hermeneutics, is that what narration does for us is it creates a hypothetical space, a sort of critical think tank where we can, or a thought experiment is the term that philosophers use, where we can start to play with a lot of different ideas and scenarios in order to understand what we ought to do, or what we might want to do, or how things in the future might look. These are the kinds of questions that come up. And I was curious, with some recent interaction I saw you had on social media with the GameStop controversy, and this idea that for those who don't know what the GameStop controversy is, my understanding is that hedge fund investors saw an opportunity to make money by selling GameStop's stock short, and then to buy it back at a cheaper rate. And then Reddit users bought the stock and drove the price up. I think that's a very simplistic version of that. But this is a lot of critics have said we need some kind of regulation. We need some way of stopping this. And I think you made the comment that correct me if I'm wrong, if you provide the kind of strong regulation, you lose the idea of what we think of as in terms of an efficient free market in some respect.
Yeah, I mean, what I had seen was some people saying, you know, short selling should be banned. You know, they're betting against the growth of the economy. You know, they're betting, and that is definitely true. But you got to have that downward pressure on markets, right? And it's been tried before. California had a huge mining stock meltdown, and I guess I should say that as a result of the Comstock Lodes discovery in 1859, these massive financial markets for investing in mining stocks grew up in San Francisco, and it's quite possibly ahead of Wall Street in terms of market development in the 1860s and 1870s. That kind of mining development's tremendously expensive. You can only really do it with financial market backing. An individual investor can't front that amount of money to invest in those workings. So anyway, they were also super prone to fraud and manipulation, these stock markets, and misinformation. So there was a massive meltdown in 1878 over one of the Comstock mines that somebody had puffed, had inflated on the circulation of information that did not prove to be accurate. And so zillions of common speculators in California lost their shirts, and they were mad at the markets. So in and there was a big pressure to rewrite the California Constitution, state constitution, which happened in 1880, and short selling, time sales were banned. And it ruined the California financial market. You know, all the mining stocks went to New York. And that's because you can't have a good market without being able to bet on both directions of outcome. You know, you got to have an upside and a downside. And it forces the companies to allocate their capital more efficiently. If you think a company's doing a bad job, you short them and they feel that pain. And so they have a very strong incentive to get better. You take that away and there's not that downward pressure, it'll take much longer for stocks to find their intrinsic value. And it's terrible for markets. If we banned that in the United States, all those big companies that are listed in New York would relist in London by the end of the week. It just doesn't work without that.
I suppose a radical opponent of the view would say something, well, we need control over the global market in that sense, and unrealistic.
You know, I think, yeah, it's unrealistic to think that that these things are very, are somewhat chaotic, I should say. They're not completely chaotic, but they're somewhat chaotic, and it just can't be controlled. And the fact of regulating them would destroy what value they have, which is super significant.
And have you been asked to provide any kind of historical comment on current economics based upon your research on the Comstock load?
No, I thought I should reach out to the woman I did. They have a history-based column with the Washington Post that I did an editorial for. I'd meant to reach out to them about doing one, but I sort of didn't get it together. And I think I've probably missed the opportunity at this point. What you said earlier, the classics thing is, you know, those who do not learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat its mistakes. I think that the more sort of measured historians reply to that was, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
That's good. I've never heard that one before, but
yeah.
Excellent. What's your next project? Is there anything that's arisen?
Yeah, I'm staying in Northern Nevada. I'm researching the Indian Wars in the 1860s and 1870s between the Paiutes, the Shoshones, and the Bannocks, and, you know, the invading white culture. And the main character, I think, is going to be Sarah Winnemucca, who is going to be Sarah Winnemucca. She was the daughter of Chief Winnemucca, for whom the town of Winnemucca, Nevada is named, and Chief Truckee's granddaughter. Truckee is the guy that the Truckee River was named for, famous Paiute chief. Truckee insisted that she go and live with a white gold rush family in California in the 1850s when she was, you know, I think about 8 to 12. And so she learned fluent English. She spoke it very well and could read and write it. Truckee had become convinced that a cornerstone of white power was literacy, right? Their ability to send a message ungarbled through space and time, right? That's a big power. And he wanted his people to have part of that. So he made sure that his granddaughter got educated in reading and writing. And so in the 1850s, the Paiutes were under pressure in Nevada from the California Trail immigration, but it's the Comstock Lode discovery in 1859 that is the absolute calamity for the Indians of the Great Basin, because the mining boom happens and all of a sudden the whites aren't just passing through, but coming out to stay, you know, in their relentless quest for mineral wealth. So she becomes this big go-between Native culture and United States culture, where you got to figure that Truckee's strategic vision is, how do I get my people through this impending calamity? And although he died and didn't see that through, aspects of his vision were successful. The Paiutes are, you know, still intact today. They're one of the few Indian nations that still occupies at least the core of their ancestral homelands around Pyramid Lake in Nevada, if not all of it. So that's kind of the story. And Sarah Winnemuck is a hell of a character. You know, she fought both for and against the United States Army. She was tremendously personally courageous. She liked to drink and party and fight. And, you know, she's a real pistol and a really interesting woman who seems to have been quite committed to, you know, helping her people find a footing in this vastly changed world. You know, and the Paiutes had been in Nevada for 11,000 years. The continuity of their historical culture based on the archaeological evidence is astounding. You know, there's no Western culture that can claim 11,000 years of roots in the same place. That's just astounding. And I'm really fascinated by place, both as an author and as a person, right? So both of those books that you've liked, China's Wings and The Bonanza King, I think have a pretty strong sense of place.
The kind of philosophy I do actually has, there's a specific subfield of it called the philosophy of place.
Oh, and really?
Yeah, it looks at the way in which, because I suppose there's two kinds of biases, and by bias, I don't mean they're particularly bad. It's just the way things have tended to go within Western history of philosophy. They tend to look at things with either an direct or indirect preference for temporal relation without maybe even mentioning temporal relation. So things are just kind of taken in relation to points. Everything's looked at as a point in time, as it were. And maybe in terms of just a linear progression from A to B to C to D and how it might change from stage to stage. The other bias is that when it tries to talk about place, it really just talks about empty space. And so the classic example of this is if you get your typical thought experiment in a philosophy class, maybe it's the philosophy of mind or it's a module that course that mentions Descartes. They'll talk about skepticism or how we might know other minds. And the way in which they construct these thought experiments is always kind of in a vacuum. They're just these two people, and they're trying to discuss the way in which they might know each other, the contents of each other's mind or whatever that might be. But what philosophy of place tries to emphasize is the primacy in which actually thinking about space in terms of a vacuum, that's a secondary theoretical move. What happens is we're rooted to our place and how that has a direct influence on the way in which we cognize and we go about, we practice things in our daily life. But I'm going off tangent there, but that's sort of,
That's interesting. One of the big fallacies of the United States experiment is that the United States was this vast empty space when we showed up, and it surely was not. You know, literally every inch of North America belonged to one native culture or another, and they all knew exactly where the boundaries were between where they were in the core of their homeland, where they were in somebody else's homeland, and what might have been the boundary areas where they were okay, but not necessarily perfectly secure. I mean, they all knew that in the same way that you know where your street ends. And so, you know, this vast extermination and removal of native cultures is another one of the dark sides of American history. I mean, we basically have to come to grips with that legacy and the legacy of slavery in a realistic way, you know, in order to progress in our culture. I think, you know, we have these two reckonings in front of us, and we have to make them.
That's a good way of putting it, and I agree on that. As we're coming to the end of this podcast series, I have to turn more, we've had a lot of philosophy in the guise of history, and now I turn a bit more explicitly to philosophical questions. The first one is, throughout your research and history, or just, you know, maybe it's just something that you do on the side as a surfer or a mountaineer, is there any one philosopher or philosophical idea that you found particularly helpful and inspiring?
Well, I'm pretty ignorant. I'm not going to jump into a conversation about philosophers and philosophy, but I can say what my own personal take on everything is, you know, I really believe in the value of time. I sort of at a quite early age came to the conclusion that there's only one thing that any of us own, and that's time. You own your time. You don't know how much of it you have. You might drop dead tonight, or you get hit by a bus when I get out of the car here or whatever. So you don't know how much of it you have, and you never get 1 second of it back. You know, we travel down this one-way arrow on time. So At a pretty early age, I came to the conclusion that I ought to be doing things that I loved and that seemed really worthwhile, kind of at no matter what other cost, and that I ought to be spending that time with people that I really care about, you know, my family and friends that I really love. And that has been the absolute governing arc of my life. And I'm 55 now, so I'm probably well over halfway along that arrow, but I don't look back with any significant regrets. You know, I feel like I have used my time wisely. And when considering the information that I had at any particular time, I probably would have made the same decisions again. You know, if I had perfect information from the future, I'd have certainly made some different ones, but you don't ever get that. So, you know, like, wise use of time and spending my time doing things that are worthwhile is super important to me. And, you know, whether that's, I invested the better part of 15 years in climbing, but I was super compelled by those outcomes, you know, by what I could learn from climbing. And at a certain point, I was actually writing Enduring Patagonia is what gave me the epiphany of like, wow, I'm not so sure I have all that much more to learn from this. I could get better at it and the geography could change. And, you know, the big hole in my mountaineering career is that I never went big in Asia. I never went to the Karakoram or the Himalayas and tried a big first ascent on one of those peaks, but I did some pretty good ones in Alaska and Patagonia. And I didn't think that I was going to learn anything more other than new geography. The emotional experience of total commitment was going to be essentially the same. And the only thing that was going to really change was the risk factor was going to go through the roof. And it was plenty high enough where I was at that time. My son had just been born. I took one more trip to Alaska with Jim Danini. And although we had a good time on that trip, my heart wasn't just in it. You know, it didn't seem like the thing that was most compelling to me at that time. And like rabid desire had always been my like edge as a mountaineer, like rabid, overwhelming desire. And without that, I couldn't make the equation of risk worthwhile. So I sort of backed off that kind of climbing and started, you know, my writing interests had been progressing. And I've always loved books, you know, I've always loved to read. That's my longest standing love. And it's my preferred form of recreation. You leave me at home alone, I will not turn on a video or a show or something. I'll whip a book off the shelves every time. And I read tons of trashy mysteries, for example, and that seems super worthwhile to me. Whereas watching like Peaky Blinders by myself feels like desperate and depressing. So
is it fair to say that this way of paying deliberate attention to time and being thankful for it, knowing the finite relationship one has to time, when you write the stories that you do and you do your research, do you think that it's a way of providing testimony or testament to someone who has lived their life worthwhile, and that these stories are not only stories about learning about a certain period of history, learning about characters, the people and their triumphs, but also do you feel that there are, that you only want to write about characters where there is some kind of moral virtue to their story?
Not necessarily. I do see where you're going with that. And certainly with William Bond and John Mackey, those were guys that I felt were deserving of much more historical recognition than they had received. And I think both were basically good, honorable men, although, you know, not perfect, but, you know, they were doing their best and doing right by and large. I have never actually tackled somebody that I thought was outright evil as a main character. So, you know, maybe there's something to that. You spend so much time with these people as a writer that you have to like them in some way. But, you know, like in The Bonanza King, even the bad guys like William Sharon, I liked and I have some sympathy for. And indeed, I got a letter from one of his descendants saying thank you, like that I had been the author most fair, that he felt had been most fair to William Sharon, and that was kind of nice. And indeed, I've met Mackey's great great grandson, and I've met all of William Bond's descendants, and they all have positive things to say about the work that I've done, which is really nice.
Last question, then, before we conclude, do you have any parting words of wisdom for our audience? Read my books.
Yeah, read more books would certainly be one of it. I think a fundamental problem in American society is that people watch their news now instead of read it. It's a very different emotional experience watching the news than reading it. And watching it is all about emotional impact and trying to get the best soundbite, whereas the world is not soundbites. There's no subject that is so unsophisticated that it can be summed up in a bumper sticker, right? They're all pretty complicated topics, and there's, you know, legitimate viewpoints on many different sides of many issues. I certainly think there are some that there aren't legitimate viewpoints on the other side, but, you know, many viewpoints do, and you just don't get the ability to think about them meaningfully if you don't read them, I don't think. So read more would be my big piece of advice. And the second one is totally obvious as well, is, you know, use your time wisely, because it's the only thing that you have. You don't own anything else other than your time.
Gregory Crouch, thank you for joining us on Living Philosophy, and good luck with your next book project. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you very much.
For more on Greg's reviews and books, please visit his website at gregcrouch.com or check out the podcast blurb for more information. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share and subscribe. My name is Dr. Todd May. Thank you for joining us on Living Philosophy, and I hope you'll join us for our next podcast. Until then, don't just read philosophy, live philosophically.